This episode of The Lou Rockwell Show is sponsored by...
Is the growth of government driving you crazy? Is it frustrating you that you can't do anything about it? Now you can. Join the Free State Project. Move to New Hampshire and get active with other liberty activists who have already slowed the growth of government in New Hampshire. Go to freestateproject.org.
This is The Lou Rockwell Show.
It's great to have as our guest this morning Dr. Tom Woods. Tom is Senior Fellow in American History at the Mises Institute. He's the author of 8 books and really now 9 books. And today, Tom, I want to talk to you about your newest book, which is all too timely. It's called Meltdown, a free market look at why the stock market collapsed, the economy tanked, and government bailouts will make things worse. So, Tom, here we are in the middle of this horrible economic episode, not only in our own country, but in the whole world. And some people are saying that we weren't Keynesian enough, that we need more Keynesianism, we need more government spending, more money creation, more regulation, more of everything that the state blesses us with. You take a different approach.
Well, I do take rather a different approach. That's right, Lou. It seemed to me that in the midst of a crisis of this magnitude that, you know, my being the ever optimist, I always want to try to find some kind of silver lining in it. And it seems to me the silver lining is that we might be able to, you know, emerge from it with people more knowledgeable about our point of view and people less likely to fall for the claim that the free market did this. Yeah, right. Yeah, like the Federal Reserve System is part of the free market. You know, it's just an unbelievable libel that's being spread. But yes, of course, that's the diagnosis, that we haven't had enough Keynesianism, we haven't had enough spending and all the rest of it. But, you know, the answer to that is twofold. I mean, one could go into a theoretical exposition of why Keynesianism is all wrong, and our people have done that. In fact, there's a whole book that was produced, from what I understand, out of the Mises Institute's 1989 conference on Keynes, and you can find that book on the Mises Institute site. But you can also, just for the layman, you know, who just is searching for answers and doesn't have much theoretical background, you can simply point out, first of all, the fact is that starting in 2001, we had this mad money creation spree for the precise reason that we were told in 2001 that what we need is more money creation, more this and that, to get out of the hole of 2000-2001 in the wake of the dot-com bust. So we were told that the way out of that one was more money creation and so on. Well, what more money creation, of course, has done, creating money out of thin air doesn't actually give the economy any more resources than it has. So all it can do is set the economy on an unsustainable investment path. The low interest rates that result artificially from this pumping in of additional money simply encourages investors to make investment decisions that, from the point of view of the economy as a whole and the resources that have been saved, can't be sustained. And so it, in effect, encourages a phony boom. Well, so in other words, what caused the situation we're in now was precisely the advice we're being told to follow now. Whereas if we had let the economy just bottom out in 2001, if we had let that recession run its course, well, we wouldn't have had this ongoing housing bubble. Because, you know, it's not a coincidence that it's right around 2001 that the myths of the housing bubble really begin to spread. The idea that, you know, houses never go down in value, they're the best investment you can make, you can flip houses for a living. Well, why do those myths take hold? Partly because this is the first, 2000-2001 is the first recession on record in which new housing starts did not decline. And that's largely because all this artificial money is being pumped in. So that gives people this false impression that, well, everything else may fall, but housing never does. So by postponing the downturn in effect of 2001, we gave ourselves this worse one. So if we try to postpone this one, it's simply going to get all the worse. And then secondly, again, I hesitate to use all these empirical examples, but, you know, Japan did follow all this advice. I mean, Paul Krugman's protestations to the contrary notwithstanding, they followed every bit of this advice. You know, they nationalized part of their banking industry. They spent trillions of yen on public works projects. They dropped interest rates down to zero. They flooded the economy with money. I mean, they propped up zombie companies. They had a bailout fund for rotten companies. And, you know, what did it do? I mean, they're still down overwhelmingly from where they were 18 years ago. And yet the same thing is being proposed to us today, by and large, by the same people. It really goes to show, you know, Murray's rule was right, Rothbard's law that nobody ever resigns. You know, I can't not only has Krugman not resigned, he's writing for the New York Times.
Well, it's quite astounding when you think, well, it seems to me one only has to stop and think for a moment, that if spending every dime you can possibly get your hands on and money creation, if these are the path to prosperity, how come the whole world isn't prosperous?
Well,
how
yeah.
come, you know, Zimbabwe isn't living it up and all doing very well?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we would have found the anytime you hear this type of solution whereby, you know, the economy can be restored to health in the absence of the creation of real stuff. That the idea that we can just restore the economy to health either with labor unions or minimum wage laws or additional money creation, well, then again, you have to answer the question, that, well, why doesn't Bangladesh just do that? You know, why has it actually required an awful lot of effort and saving and capital accumulation in the past to raise people to a condition of civilized life? And so therefore, why wouldn't that be the path we need to take today?
Somebody wrote me and told me about an ad that they'd heard on a radio station where a dad is explaining to his daughter that even though she's a wonderful little girl, she's helping keep the economy in crisis by keeping all her money in her piggy bank. And that she needs to spend that money because, for example, if she buys a toy, then the toy store owner is doing better. He can do, his employees will do better, and really the whole economy will do better. And so everybody needs to spend every dime in their piggy bank. But again, you know, I guess because we have such a subservient media to the state and the academic world, with the exception of a few heroic people like you, Tom, are all going along with this sort of thing with the Keynesian prescriptions and the old Keynesian nostrums, no matter how discredited they are, that no one's, people seem to think that the most unbelievable baloney coming out of Washington makes sense.
And of course, when you think about it, I mean, what exactly, in part, you know, got us into this mess? It's that people bought too much house. They were sort of misled into buying more house than they should have bought. And because house prices seem to be forever appreciating, well, then they used the built-up equity in their homes to buy still more stuff. And now that reality is hitting them, and they now realize that if they had known what the value of their house, you know, what its trajectory was likely to be in the future, they wouldn't have consumed as much as they had. Now they're retrenching. And that makes perfect sense because, in effect, what they've done is they borrowed too much and consumed too much. So to give them the advice that consuming still more will solve the problem is really just staggering in its absurdity. But you know, but needless to say, this is the conventional wisdom, and you know, it's because of the prevalence of ideas like this that you know we can be thankful that in this day and age, at least, you know, we have the internet, so that places like the Mises Institute and LouRockwell.com can spread the real message, so that people who are skeptical of what they're being fed have some kind of, you know, intellectual meat, you know, something they can really chew on. And I'm happy to point out, Lou, this is entirely spontaneous. Nobody asked me to give this testimonial, but I am grateful in my own life that in 1993 I went to the Mises University program, which is the Mises Institute's week-long summer program for students. And I had never been exposed to these ideas before. I barely knew who Rothbard was. I more or less knew who Mises was. But, you know, a lot of the think tanks who liberally invoke the names Mises and Hayek consistently shy away from their more politically incorrect positions, particularly their opposition to the central bank. But yet, today, that's the most important thing they can teach us, is the opposition to the central bank, the explanation as to what causes the business cycle. And I got this foundation then, and I've been hooked since. And in fact, it would not have been possible for me to write this book if I had not had that foundation and that encouragement to learn in this tradition that I got from Mises University. Because for a book like this, the idea behind it for me was that I've got to get a book on this subject out quickly, because every crank and lunatic and, you know, basically, you know, hungover Keynesian is going to have a book coming out by the summertime. I got to rush something out so that the Austrians, in effect, have, you know, more or less the first word on this, so that at least it's slightly harder for, you know, the blockheads in the media to pretend that the free market caused this. I want to give a good, easy-to-understand overview as to why that's not right and why, in fact, it's the interference with the market that has led us into this terrible mess. So I'm, you know, I'm very grateful to you and the Institute for making this possible.
Tom, one of my great memories of that 93 program is looking over during the barbecue at the end of the conference and seeing you and Murray early in the evening animatedly talking together. And then I come back hours later and you're still, you know, animatedly talking together. And it was just a great, I know that was a great moment in your life. And Murray is up there saying, attaboy to you for this book, because we certainly have, you know, you build on all the great Austrian economists, whether it's Rothbard or Mises, Hayek, and the others. But you've put this together in a way that, you know, for the proverbial intelligent layman, for any American who's concerned about what the heck is happening to our economy, what lies ahead for us, why are we in this trouble, and what can we do about it, this is the book to read, Meltdown.
Well, I appreciate that, Lou. And you know, I have two things to say. First is that Murray was an extremely generous person, you know, in addition to being a genius. And, you know, because, you know, who was I, you know, at that time? You know, just some kid. And he generously gave of himself in those situations and was extremely encouraging. And I'll never forget, there were two little incidents I remember. First, the second time I saw Murray was also in an environment where there were a lot of students. And he entered the room and he walked right up to me and said, "Hi, Tom." And I looked at the other students and I just said, "Eat your heart out. Come on." Right? And then secondly, you know, I recall, you know, not only that, you know, he stayed up late and, you know, was always, you know, always interested in talking to people, but, you know, he was just, you know, he would, if you had even the slightest inkling of a paper topic or something, you know, he was ready, you know, as, you know, he was like David Gordon in that he was just a bibliography of just endless sources, you know, and I remember at the end of one of these long conversations when I said, "Well, you know, Professor Rothbard," and he said, "Call me Murray." And I thought, you know, I don't think I can. I just don't think I can do that. But with regard to the book, you're right. I mean, in effect, what I'm trying to do is, you know, convey all this stuff to the layman and provide some ammunition for people who feel like, you know, they're really getting it from all sides. You know, like family members are telling them, you know, just what they're reading in the papers, that capitalism is dead and so on and so forth. You know, and we've got people around the current president now saying that, you know, we can't let this crisis go to waste. We have to exploit it to expand the state. So, of course, their interpretation of the crisis is going to be that the market has failed, because only that interpretation will justify their additional power grab. So we need to be able to defend ourselves and show that their account of what has happened is utterly implausible, and it is absurd to blame on the free market a problem that is caused in almost every one of its particulars by the Federal Reserve System, which we cannot repeat enough is not part of the free market.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Do you want liberty in your lifetime? The Free State Project is our best chance. We are people who know that liberty will not be achieved by more of the same tactics and are committed to a strategy that will work. Check us out on the web at freestateproject.org. That's freestateproject.org.
You know, if we read Murray Rothbard's great book, America's Great Depression, we see that, of course, the myth that was really fastened on almost everybody's brain during the 1930s and subsequently, that Hoover was a free market guy, the free market had failed, thank goodness we had Franklin Roosevelt who fixed everything. Of course, Hoover was the first New Dealer, he was a horrible statist. Franklin Roosevelt didn't fix anything, he made everything worse. But to what extent are they succeeding in telling these lies and making them fixed in people's brains again today about this current crisis?
Yeah, it's amazing to me that the old view of Hoover is somehow being resurrected when, you know, any competent historian knows, in effect, at least that part of Rothbard's story now. I mean, when Murray was telling that story in 1963 in America's Great Depression, it was still kind of revisionist history. But today, you know, you would think with our advances in our knowledge, everybody knows. Any competent historian knows this. And I think the specialists do know this. The specialists typically do know it. I mean, there is a reason that, you know, Franklin Roosevelt condemned Hoover as the biggest spendthrift in American history. And Roosevelt's vice presidential nominee said that Hoover was leading the country down the road to socialism. I mean, you know, why did they say these things, right? But it's true that, you know, I think the average person, you know, is busy, doesn't have, you know, a lot of time to study these things, and so is going to read what he, you know, going to read Salon or read what's in the New York Times or read Paul Krugman or whatever, and be under the impression that, yep, you know, I guess Herbert Hoover just sat back and did nothing, just like George W. Bush. How somebody, though, can be persuaded to live in that alternate universe, I just don't know. I mean, how you could first think that George W. Bush was a free marketeer is beyond me. But then, you know, Hoover's record is pretty much out there for everybody to see. And FDR's own aides said, admitted, like Rexford Tugwell actually admitted, that in effect we're really just extrapolating from the programs that, that Hoover started. And today, now the claim is on part of people like Krugman that, you know, we're really not being fair to Roosevelt, that if you do different sort of employment statistics series, you know, you come up with a slightly better record for Roosevelt. But, I mean, you know, this is just playing with the numbers. I mean, anybody who lived during that time knows, you know, how many people were out of work. And then the claim is that, you know, things were really starting to look up. You know, FDR's programs were really doing well until about 1937, when we got the so-called depression within the depression. And that was supposedly because at that time Roosevelt was not spending as much on public works projects, and that's what did it. Well, first of all, if after 4 years of recovery, so-called, the economy still needs the government building crummy, politically motivated bridge projects to keep it going, then how sound has this recovery been in the first place? But secondly, you know, left out of this account is that it's right around this time that the Supreme Court had ratified some of the new labor laws that were giving real teeth to labor unionism in the U.S. And right around the time of 1937, just in that one-year period, wages suddenly rose by about 13% all of a sudden. You think that might have had, you know, a teensy-weensy bit to do with why the economy turned down? But that can never be the answer we're allowed to get. It's always that they haven't ever spent enough. And this is a good reminder for the scholars among us that of the importance of economic theory, as dull as that sounds. Because if you don't have sound economic theory, you will forever be arguing with Paul Krugman, because he's going to always say it's never enough. It's $1 trillion of spending, it's not enough. It's a Google of spending, it's not enough. You know, a Google dollars spent is not enough. How are you ever going to resolve that back and forth unless you've got some sound theoretical understanding about why it is that merely using things up can't possibly make a country prosperous?
Murray Rothbard, who of course was not only an economist and a political philosopher, but also an American historian, was always bothered by the fact that while there were always some good economists, always some good political philosophers, there were no historians who knew any economics, who in fact were culpably ignorant of economics, those who weren't just active proponents of evil. So Tom, here we have you, a historian who was an economist too, and that's, I think, what gives such life to your books. I mean, your books are bestsellers. I urge anybody who may, some of the few Americans who haven't read Tom Woods, one of Tom Woods' books, be sure to take a look at Meltdown, because he's such an extraordinary writer, and he brings to his study of history and economics a tremendous life that just makes these books a pleasure to read. You start reading it, and you're through to the end before you know what's happened to you, and you know a whole lot more. And you certainly know a whole lot more than you're hearing in the media. So here, Tom, we have this work of both history and economics, Meltdown, where you're telling us what happened in the Great Depression, what happened with Hoover and Roosevelt. But what about the fact that another alarming thing that we hear about the old days, and I'm afraid for the current days, is it's the conventional wisdom that World War II cured the Depression. That it was the magnificence of, I guess, killing all the unemployed and totally socializing the economy that somehow made everything okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this one, of course, Bob Higgs is the guy who's done so much work on it. That is something that I address in there, because you're right. There is plenty of history in here, in addition to talking about the bailouts and talking about gold and money and all the things people need to know about, business cycles and stuff. You know, I talk about all the panics of the 19th century. Because people say, well, look, there wasn't a Fed in the 19th century. How can you blame those things on the Fed? So I go and explain what was causing these panics in the 19th century. And then, given that another argument is that even by some of the sort of good guys, you know, who understand FDR wasn't so good, is that, well, you know, World War II finally got us out of the Depression. I mean, there are a couple of sort of crude versions of this. I mean, one is that just the mere act of producing guns and bombs put people to work and that ended the Depression. I think the Krugman argument is slightly less crude, believe it or not. I think it's simply that this sort of just jump-started the process of people spending again. But what I'm showing in here is really just building on what Bob Higgs has done, which is, you know, first to sort of make a logical case that You know, obviously, if you're preparing for war and you're taxing the, you know, 60% of the population to support the 40% of the population that's in the armed forces or civilian employees of the armed forces or in the so-called defense industry, you know, that doesn't create wealth. I mean, all you're doing is just subsidizing one part of the population at the expense of another. And the part that you're subsidizing is producing goods that consumers can't even use. So this obviously can't, you know, this doesn't really mean much. Secondly, you know, Bob Higgs points out that, you know, presumably I don't need to draw you a diagram to show what happens when, you know, 11 million people are drafted into the armed forces. You know, unemployment does go down. You know, I will concede this. You know, if I lined them all up and shot them, that would solve an unemployment problem. But that's not how a healthy economy solves it. But then beyond that, he says that the statistics on which this claim is based, you know, you look at the national income accounting statistics during these years, and it looks like, hey, we've got a big boom. But for one thing, this shows the shortcomings of GDP because it, you know, it includes government spending as if government spending is a contribution to rather than a predation upon the economy. You know, if the government spends $200 on a $120 item, that's marked as a $200 added to GDP. I mean, this is obviously a misleading statistic. But beyond that, if you're even going to try to aggregate all these purchases over the course of a year, the point is that the purchases have to be meaningful in some sense. In other words, when people buy and sell freely, they generate market prices. But if the government just simply says, well, the price of X is going to be $10, well, that's not a freely generated price. It's a meaningless, arbitrary price. So, for instance, if the government said, from now on, the price of eggs is $1 an egg, and we, the government, are going to purchase 10 million eggs. So 10 million eggs times $1 an egg gives us $10 million added to GDP. In what way is that a meaningful measurement, such as it is, of the state of the economy? It's a completely arbitrary figure. And given how deeply and how systemically controlled the U.S. economy was during the war, so many of these prices are arbitrary prices generated by the government for its purchases. So therefore, you add up all these arbitrary prices, and then you have spillover effects of this arbitrariness throughout the rest of the economy, and the result is you have one gigantic arbitrary number that doesn't actually mean anything. And finally, I think both Higgs and veteran Galloway point out that if all this is true, that just the mere act of just crazy spending creates prosperity, then 1946 should have been the worst year on record. You know, we're bringing all these men home. We're not spending all this money overseas anymore. Well, this should have been terrible depression. And we were warned about this by some Keynesians. Well, we're going to sink into depression. And if you look at the GDP figures, 1946 is one of the worst years on record. But if you actually look at, you know, the statistics that matter, the private economy, how much is being produced, employment, it's the single most productive, explosively productive year in American history because finally some semblance of normal economic order is restored.
Tom Woods, thanks so much for writing this book. Talk about a book that we need at this exact moment in time. Ladies and gentlemen, read Meltdown, read Tom's other books. You can get them at Mises.org. They're all for sale, too, at LouRockwell.com. Look at Tom's archive on LouRockwell.com. At the bottom of his archives list some of his best-selling books. Click on those links. Buy them. Every one of these books is wonderful, whether Tom is writing about American history, about the truths about American history that you're not supposed to know. And this book is all about that. This book is about both economic truth and historical truth that's hidden by the current regime, by its friends in the media, by its friends in academia. But Tom Woods, you're telling the truth, and boy, it's truth that we need to hear right now about what's happened to our country, what's happened to the whole Western world, why it didn't have to happen, why it doesn't have to happen in the future. So if you want to be armed against all the liars and the propagandists that surround most of us every single day from Washington and all the other power centers in the U.S., read Meltdown. Let me give you the subtitle, too. Meltdown, a free market look at why the stock market collapsed. The economy tanked, and government bailouts will make things worse. It's from Regnery, and I predict, as with other Tom Woods books, soon on the New York Times bestseller list, too. Tom Woods, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Lou.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. Thanks for listening.